Hello, this is Scriptlock, where we talk about storytelling in video games. I'm Nick Folkman.
And I'm Max Folkman. Today's guests are Rosa Dackler and Ben Arfman. Rosa works at Criterion Games, where she was previously an audio designer and is currently a narrative designer. Her credits include Battlefield 1, Star Wars Battlefront, Rogue One X-Wing VR Mission, Star Wars Battlefront 2, and Battlefield 5's Firestorm Mode. Ben is a writer and director of film and TV, and he was also a writer on last year's Spider-Man game from Insomniac. Thanks for coming on, you two.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having us. Exciting.
Yeah. So I think we'll start with Rosa. How'd you get into the game industry?
Okay. Well, I did have a regular job before I was in the games industry. I worked at an Apple store, and I really loved it. I loved the people, but the work was not as creative as I liked, and I decided to escape retail and try to do the most ridiculous thing I could think of, basically. And then if that didn't work, I'd go to the next most ridiculous thing I could think of. And the games industry seemed totally impenetrable, and I had no idea if I would be able to get in. I didn't think I would, but I loved sound. I grew up playing music. The sound is as much a part of what I love in games as anything else. So I thought, I'll go do that. I'll study. I'll pick a university where there are a lot of game studios. So I went to Surrey University in Guildford, and I thought maybe if I go there, I'll be able to knock on some doors or camp out in front of people's doors and they'll give me an internship. And amazingly, it worked. So I went to Criterion Games as an audio intern, and I absolutely fell in love with sound design. It was an amazing experience. And a couple of years after I started as a sound designer properly, we realized we needed a narrative team. And I was like, me please. And so I switched over because we'd been working on a lot of games where we were starting to introduce story and characters. And the audio team just ended up doing a lot of that work because we were working on VO, talking to writers, thinking about delivery of the story. And I'd never thought about narrative design when I first got into the industry, but it felt like a really natural fit having seen what the work was actually like. So yeah, here I am.
Had you been doing narrative work before then, like personal narrative work or like writing of any kind?
I mean, yeah, weirdly, in retrospect, you look back and now I'm like, oh yeah, I did spend my entire childhood and teenage years coming up with worlds and backstories for worlds and character sheets. And I did love games with powerful stories in them. And I did mod Neverwinter Nights and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, the breadcrumbs are all there, but I just couldn't see it until somebody said, hey, have you ever thought about doing this? And yeah, now it feels like my whole life was kind of building towards it. I just had no idea at the time.
And was it easy to go from audio to narrative design?
Yes, in that our studio was starting a new narrative team, and I like early days, small teams, you know, figuring out what the work is. And because I found that a lot of the things that audio has, a lot of the problems audio has, are the same as what narrative has. Kind of where audio was a few years ago is where I feel like narrative design is now, when people think, you know, you run into the same issues. Oh, we only need one person to do that job. Or do we even need someone to do that job? So yeah, a lot of it feels very familiar. And the tough stuff is just, it is the definition. What is the definition of the role? You know, how do you establish a new team within a studio? And fortunately, everyone's been very welcoming and very enthusiastic and excited about it. So it's had unique challenges, but it's actually spookily similar to audio in a lot of ways.
How do you establish a new team in a studio?
By making friends, by being hyper communicative, by finding out what, I mean, I felt really lucky in that I had been an audio designer before at the studio. And I always tell narrative folks to make friends with the audio team if they can, because those people are used to having to getting all up in every other department's business, finding out what they're doing, you know, trying to understand the development process as it goes so that they can predict what work they'll have to do. And narrative's in a similar situation. So I found that leveraging the connections I'd made as an audio designer was very useful when we were setting up the narrative team. And a lot of it's evangelizing the department, you know, talking about what it means, what it is, because it is fundamentally misunderstood. Kind of like how people think that sound design is music sometimes. People think that narrative is just script writing. So a lot of it's just education, finding out, you know, someone will talk about a game that they loved and you go, yeah, I really liked this bit of the narrative design or something. And they're like, wait, that's narrative design? That I didn't think, I thought that was, you know, an accident of gameplay with some words and, you know, stuff like that. It's a lot of education and also trying to understand every other department's business and workflow and figure out how you can fit to that, because you can't expect them all to fit to you.
What department do you know the least about?
Ooh, that's a good question. Well, I definitely don't have the in-depth programming chops that I wish I did. I understand enough about it to have a conversation. And something that I'm not super understanding of is the technical infrastructure that lies underneath games, which is less relevant to my department, but it still does come into it when you start talking about memory and things like that. So I'm learning a lot about that right now. And it is really fun, actually, weirdly, but that's probably the one I know the least about. I also don't understand, I mean, I love art, but I can't draw at all. So that's the one that looks most like black magic to me, in that I just love watching artists work, and I am amazed every single day at what they can do. And I still haven't quite figured out how they manage to be so creative within such tight constraints, because they usually are really constrained. So yeah, I'd love to learn more about that.
What about you, Ben?
Which department do I know the least about? Or
yeah.
Yeah. I would say programming as well. Yeah, I took like a C++ class in high school years and years ago, and that's kind of the extent of my knowledge there. Yeah, Rosa, I want to ask you questions about how you define narrative design, because we keep having that conversation internally at Insomniac. We don't have any narrative designers, and so we keep getting into debates about, like, well, what is that? Do we need that? Who is that person? It is really interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think
you could ask them if you want.
Yeah, I love having that conversation.
Yeah. Well, so okay. Yeah, sorry to hijack then.
No, it's great. Do it.
How would you define that role?
So I've actually stolen a phrase from Molly Maloney recently.
Past guest Molly Maloney.
Yes, the famous Molly Maloney, and she gave this wonderful talk at GDC last year that I saw, and she and her partner gave the talk, and you know, one of them is a narrative designer, one's a writer. They were talking about that relationship, and the top line that she used for it that I use a lot, which isn't super practical, but it is a nice framing for it, is that both a writer and a narrative designer are responsible for the story. The writer is responsible for it from the character's point of view. The narrative designer is responsible for it from the player's point of view.
Which
it's nice, right? Because it means that you can kind of apply that to any genre. Like, it works for Telltale, and it works for Battlefield, and it works for most genres, where I can write and I have the headspace for doing that and I have the knowledge to do it, but primarily I'm not actually thinking about, is this the right plot arc? Is this a satisfying character development? I'm thinking, what are the ways that we can show what's happening in the story in a gameplay way, in a way that the player will not just see and experience, but will pay attention to? Like, how do we draw them to that? So it is very much sitting in between writing and design, and also hooking into every other department, depending on what your game looks like. Whereas a writer then is free to not have to worry about, oh, am I the in-engine implementer? Am I thinking about the systems? Because there's plenty of like wonderful, talented writers who do not want to have to think about systems.
Totally.
And that's okay. And that they should be allowed to not do that if that's not what they want to do. And they're the ones who are thinking about, you know, is this a great story? Is this a great, satisfying character arc? What's the snappiest, you know, way of writing this conversation, or a characterful way of saying something we need to communicate to the player? All of that can be stuff that they do. And they do need to understand narrative design, or at least some aspects of game design, to have some compassion for it and understand it. But it just frees them up to do what they want to do the most. So if you're a studio that has someone who can do both, and that's okay, then that's cool. But I feel like AAA games, they hit a point where the scale is just ridiculous, and you can't ask people to do two jobs.
Totally. That's really interesting. I like that definition and perspective a lot. And it's really like a conversation we have a lot internally, the writers among themselves, but then, you know, me with like the designers or whoever else, is always trying to keep like the player's consciousness and the protagonist consciousness in the same place. Like, ideally, if I'm playing the game and I'm interested in something I'm seeing in the world, whatever character I'm playing as should also be interested in that. And like, whatever questions I have, the character should have as well. So that's a really, that's a great way to think about it, kind of like thinking about it through the eyes of the character, thinking about it through the eyes of the player. And at least in the way that we do it, we're always kind of trying to keep those two on the same track as much as possible. Yeah, that's really cool. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's something we talk about a lot as well. And because our narrative team is tiny, as in I am the narrative design team right now. So, which, and that's nice, right? I get to write my own definition of it. But at the same time, as we grow, and we will over the next year, we'll start to see, we'll have to formalize some of this a little more. And that's where it gets really hard and really nitty gritty. Yeah, you start saying, totally. What's the actual breakdown of this? But, you know, as you go, if you do start to incorporate that a bit more, I'd love to hear how you find it. Because I think every conversation I've had about this recently has been so valuable in shaping that. So yeah, let me know if you make any great discoveries.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And on the topic of building a team, like that's, it is weird and challenging, but it's also like super exciting. Like on Spider-Man at Insomniac, it was basically just John Paquette and I were the in-house writers. And then we had Christos Gage, who's wonderful, but he wasn't working out of the office. And our writer's assistant, Jason Ragatz, and that was kind of it. But then since shipping Spider-Man, you know, we brought on Sam Maggs and Mary Kenny, and we're like slowly growing our department. And it's so much fun to bring in people who have experience at other companies and other kinds of storytelling and start to figure out, like together, okay, well, what are the kinds of stories we like to tell? How do we tell them best inside games? And how's the way that we like to approach working on those stories? Like we spend a lot of time talking about process and kind of trying out new processes, figuring out what works, what doesn't, and discarding ideas. And it's exciting. It's exciting to be building something, you know, not just a game or a story, but kind of building a team as well. It's fun.
It's so cool. I absolutely love that part of it, especially because if you do have the benefit of being in a studio large enough to have a team and you do love working with people rather than just solo, you do get to, and this, I think you were hinting at this, you do get to build a voice, like a voice of that studio.
Yeah, totally, totally.
And that's a dream. I mean, there's definitely some places that have their sound nailed down, for example. And as a sound designer, I loved it when I could fire up a game and go, oh yeah, I know exactly what game this is. I know who made this because I can hear it. And I would love to be able to have that with writing as well and with narrative design, where you fire it up and you go, I think based on how I feel right now and how this is being executed, I can tell that this is an Insomniac game, or I can tell this is a Criterion game.
That's cool. Sorry guys, if you guys want to jump in with any questions, like please
yeah,
please do. I'm just like,
this is great. Like, you gotta keep going. We're happy that, like, this is perfect, but if you want me to jump in, just let me know.
Well, so the one thing I was going to ask, just on the topic of sound, like, have you played anything recently where, you, in terms of any, however you want to define sound, but like, oh, I love the sound of this game?
So I think that the sound of Oberdin is really dynamically interesting. Oh, as in,
that's cool.
Yeah, like, so there's been a lot of amazing sounding games that have come out, and I think that God of War sounded amazing, and I haven't played Red Dead Redemption, but I've watched people play it, and obviously it's very impressive, amazing attention to detail, but Oberdin is so aesthetically singular and identifiable, so that I've really enjoyed listening to. Also, another one I should mention is Brawl Stars, the mobile game. I'm always on some kind of mobile kick. It's so shiny and it's so, you know, I have a problem now where if somebody, I actually like the design of it. It's not too compulsive. It's, you know, it rewards you kind of for like just taking a break and not playing it all day, every day. Otherwise I definitely could, but it has just a wonderful kind of rhythm and cadence to the sounds that you would interact with on a normal session. That I can kind of, if I hear somebody playing it, it feels like a familiar song almost, even though it's just a succession of like UI interactions and stuff. Yeah, it's lovely.
That's super, super cool.
I would also say the Mortal Kombat, the recent Mortal Kombat game has some amazing sound design.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Cool. Yeah, I haven't played that yet. I'll try. I'll fail, I'm sure, but I'll try.
Yeah, we had kind of a designer/writer outing last night at the studio where we went to this like game bar in Burbank. And on the flat screens there, instead of playing sports games, they like play Twitch streamers. And like half the screens last night were streaming Mortal Kombat.
Oh, wow.
And you couldn't really hear it because the bar was loud. But I will say that that's like an extremely visually interesting game. Like, yeah, there were plenty of times throughout the night where people would just like wander off while they were speaking and just start staring at the screen, watching this like hyper violence take place in front of them. I'm not a fighting game guy either, but I was definitely entranced by that game.
They're doing a lot of interesting stuff, and I've grown less interested in gore and super violence as I've gotten older, but because it's so ridiculous in that game, it is still interesting to me.
Yeah.
I have two questions built up. No, three questions from over the last like couple minutes. So I didn't know Insomniac had no narrative designers. So Ben, would you say like, are the writers doing a lot of the narrative design, or is it spread across multiple disciplines?
Yeah, it depends on who you ask internally. Like this is, like I was saying, this is kind of a question that keeps coming up again and again, which is like, hey, we don't have anybody called a narrative designer. Should we have narrative designers? Like, we love story and we're invested in telling story interactively. Shouldn't we have that? But then depending on who you talk to, yeah, maybe we already have those. Like if you're talking to me, I would say that like, yeah, everybody kind of in some way or another views themselves as a storyteller at Insomniac. And yeah, so everybody's kind of shouldering the burden of creating a cool, immersive, interactive story and finding their way to participate in that. If you talk to some other people, like one of our head designers, Cam, he does kind of think that the writers at Insomniac are essentially doing the work of narrative design that he's seen at other studios. Because it is, Rosa, like you were describing, like as a writer, you have to be somebody who's conversant with like every other department, even if you don't really know. In my case, I don't really know how programming works, so I could not step in and like do that. I at least know how to like listen to the programmers, understand where they're coming from, talk to them about my needs and understand their needs and kind of come to solutions together. So like most of my day at the office, more and more I'm trying to just like barricade myself inside a conference room and just get some actual writing done. But a lot of it is just like buzzing around the office, like talking to a designer, talking to an environment artist, like going to talk to, you know, one of our audio guys, like going to talk to a programmer. Like you end up being kind of the hub of the wheel or the spoke of the wheel, I guess. I don't know which one is correct, but that kind of allows all these other disciplines to interconnect and understand their place in the whole, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, like I don't know if we're ever going to end up with people whose title is narrative designer, but it feels to me like we have a lot of people internally who do that job, you know, or who care about.
Yeah, that's great. Kind of job. I mean, I think that I think it's worth saying that I don't know about Insomniac. It sounds like it's similar to Criterion in this way, but I know there are studios out there that have people who have their job and they come in and they do that job, and the end result of the game, they're the only person who was responsible for that. So, you know, composers, I guess, often work like this. They're the only musician, the only composer on the game. So their work is what ends up being in the game. But even then, more often than not, the resulting soundtrack is as much down to the audio person who made the dynamic music system as it is down to the composer. And similarly, so the way that the audio team, for example, at Criterion works is that everybody has their role. So like we have a technical audio designer, a creative audio designer, but they will always end up crossing over. The Venn diagram has a lot of overlap. So they'll both end up doing creative sound design. The creative sound designer will definitely do some implementation, but they have specialized. So when they, you know, when a task comes up, they'll naturally gravitate towards those things that interest them, but the crossover is huge. And I think that that's going to be impossible to avoid in narrative. Whether you're team has people with the title of just writer or writer and quest designer or narrative designer and technical narrative designer, like whatever it is, you're going to have a body of work will be done by the end of the game, and you probably won't be able to remember whose work was what in a lot of cases, which is awesome, totally, right? It's great.
It's super cool. It's like, I mean, so I have a little bit of a background in like film and TV, and that's an extremely collaborative medium, but I was blown away when I started at Insomniac with just like how collaborative by necessity games of this scale are. Because like you say, they're just enormous. There's so many people working on them that you have to be involved in everybody else's business, and everybody has to end up being involved in your business to make something great, you know? And it's really, really exciting. I'm not really like a sports guy, but this is like kind of my favorite team sport, you know, where everybody has to work together.
Yeah. So how did you get into the games industry, Ben?
Oh yeah. So it was, kind of by happenstance, I guess a little bit. I've always loved video games. Probably the first games that I fell in love with were old LucasArts point and click adventures, like Monkey Island and The Dig and Full Throttle back in the day. And so I always really loved them, but kind of similar to Rosa, like the games industry seemed like this weird magical thing on top of a mountain somewhere that I had no idea how to get into. And I never really understood programming. So I was like, well, that's not something I can do, right? But I was also really into film and TV. So I pursued a degree eventually in film production at UCLA and got my master's in film production there, and did a lot of writing while I was at school and kind of always thought that I was going to be a writer. But then right before I graduated from school, I directed a short film that was all first-person point of view. It was like a 7-minute short that was all one shot from first-person point of view. And that wound up doing pretty well. And it got me some work after I graduated directing other people's stuff. And I kind of forgot about being a writer for a little while. But because all the stuff I was doing was in this weird like POV world, I started to fall into doing some VR stuff, some live action VR, and then doing some stuff in Game Engine, and kind of gradually started working my way towards more interactive storytelling, which had always really been my passion. You know, like I love passive entertainment a lot. I love movies, but the idea of being inside a story is the most creatively inspiring. And so then it's probably like 3 years ago now, a friend of mine, one of the animators at Insomniac, Elliot, one of the key traversal animators, he hit me up and told me that the company was looking for another writer to work on the Spider-Man project. And he's like, hey, you know, you should submit your resume, apply, I'll give people a heads up. And so I did, and wound up getting a couple of interviews with John and the team. And to this day, I don't really understand why they hired me. I'm so grateful that they did. I think that I could come in and I was like so enthusiastic about Spider-Man. I was so enthusiastic about like interactive stories, and I was really cheap. You know, it made sense for them to hire me. And it wound up, it was a great experience. I loved it. And I do think that like my background in film and TV and directing, where I really had to be somebody who was able to go and talk to all these different departments, you know, whether it's talking to like the costume designer or like the prop master or having conversations with a cinematographer or an actor. I was really, really comfortable right away, just kind of jumping in and getting to know people, figuring out their discipline, figuring out what they do and how to talk to them about what they do, which I think, you know, it's not necessarily unique among game writers, but I do know a lot of game writers who kind of like to work remotely and like just hand in scripts and not really be like in, you know, the mess of production. And I love being in the mess of production. So it seemed to work out pretty well. And now 3 years later, it's like, I still love film and TV, but I cannot imagine a world where I go back to that. Like interactive storytelling is just so exciting. It's so much fun. You're solving completely new problems every day when you go into work. Everybody at Insomniac is so passionate and dedicated and talented. It's a great space to be in, a great team to be working with. And it's just exciting. Even when it's really, really hard, and it does get really, really hard sometimes, it's still, I feel so lucky to be in this space.
Well, you said that you're not really sure why they hired you in the first place. Like, I do think enthusiasm does count for a lot, because like we've worked with people who are like the opposite of enthusiastic and more cynical and just drags everyone down in some way and kind of hurts production. And it's like just being jazzed about the job you're doing gets everyone else excited and makes you just happy to do the work you're doing. And I think it's underappreciated.
Totally. Yeah. We talk a lot about work at work, and it is like morale is so important. Like you have to feel inspired when you're coming in, because it's like, it's really, really hard to make these things. Like
yeah.
any kind of game, AAA games especially, it's so complicated, it's so difficult, and there are long stretches of time where things look awful before suddenly they start working and they turn around, and you have to be able to sustain yourself through those dark periods. Like, I remember when I was at school at UCLA, one of my favorite professors, one of his like key pieces of advice was like, you know, when you're entering the creative world to try and make money off of imagining things, one of your primary jobs is just going to be fighting against feelings of despair. Like, you just have to be somebody who's going to be able to go through the dark of the cave and like have faith that you're going to find the light eventually, because there's going to be long periods of time where like either a script doesn't work or you're not finding like actual paying work, and you have to be able to sustain yourself with that kind of optimism and enthusiasm. And yeah, I agree. It's a positive attitude is really important.
Yeah, I would totally second that. I think that as well as being something that sustains you, it's something that sustains other people. And if you're in a team, I feel like it's one of the big blessings of being in a group of people that you go through whatever you're going through together. And but the downside of that is that if you are in a toxic environment or a negative environment, I mean, they're kind of the same thing, you do risk getting dragged down by that. So that's why I think it's so important when you are building your team or when you're bringing on new people. And Ben, I'm sure this is what went through their heads at Insomniac as well. You know, if in 6 months' time the project is in a slump, you know, it's a difficult time, we're trying to figure out a whole bunch of issues, because that happens even to the most successful projects, right? They're going to be asking, if this guy comes into work and we have to spend the whole day in a room together hashing something out, working through a problem, am I going to be better off for it or worse off? Because it's going to be one of the two. There's no neutral effects here. And I mean, I definitely feed off the energy of other people around me. And I think a lot of people in games, especially people involved in storytelling and anything interactive, you're always empathizing with what the players are going to experience when they play these games. And so you have a pretty high, hopefully, high level of empathy. And you hook into what everybody else around you is experiencing. And if you love the craft, that will hopefully sustain you through if the project is not super lovable right now, or if the schedule isn't super lovable right now. And people will pick up on that. And it'll make them feel better and more validated for the fact that, hey, I'm around these people who are great. That must mean that I'm okay. You know, does that make sense?
Totally, totally. I mean, that's so, you know, we're working on something now and with kind of a small team at the moment. And like everybody that I'm working with day to day, like I love. Like I would go into the office just to hang out with these people. And it's so sustaining to have that feeling of like coming into the office in the morning and just be like, oh, nice. I get to see my friends. I get to hang out with them. And like, yeah, like we're kind of in the shit on a few areas and we got to figure out problems that at the moment maybe seem unsolvable, but I'm here with people who I really like, who are way smarter than I am and are super, super creative and enthusiastic. And I have absolute confidence that we're going to figure out these things together. Yeah. It's great. Super important.
That's great. And I bet that's how they feel about you too. You know, we all,
oh, I hope so.
I'm sure it is. I mean, it's much easier to see the brilliance in people around you than it is to see it in yourself. And so that's why a supportive environment, I don't believe that there is a neutral environment. I think it's either supportive or it's toxic, because it's just going to swing you one way or the other, right? And so also, if you can be bringing that in, that's a wonderful thing. Like that's a totally valid part of the work that you're doing and the role that you play in a studio. And we never recognize that as part of your job spec or anything like that, but it's super valuable.
Yeah. Yeah. Positive feelings for the win. Yeah. Optimism. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
But you mentioned dark periods before.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask both of you, like, how do you sustain yourself through dark periods? Because you can't just use enthusiasm the entire time.
Yeah.
Yeah. You try.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. So I find anything like mood enhancing that is legal and healthy to be good. Mm. So for me, that's like music, getting outside, things like that. Anything that grounds me in reality. Getting physically away from my situation for a little bit, travel, anything that makes the world seem bigger and me seem smaller, because then my problems seem a lot smaller. And just basic, like your classic self-care stuff, but also just getting perspective on the thing that you're dealing with, Because in a studio, it does seem like the whole world, and that can be wonderful. But then as soon as it becomes difficult, that can be really unhealthy, and you need to get a little bit of distance, I find, anyway. And the other one is probably having a creative outlet that is not work. I'm not super great at this, but anytime I have a creative thing on the go that isn't my job, I just feel lighter because I'm not now staking my entire creative identity, which is fragile and easily offended and all that, on my job. I feel like I have value outside of it. And so if the job happens to be difficult, that's okay, because I have this other thing where I'm able to make something that is of value.
Yeah, that I would 100% agree with both of those things. Absolutely. Like I just, well, not just, but starting since January, started running again with a good friend of mine. And we go in the mornings for like a couple of hours, usually like 3 or 4 days a week. And that has been really, really good. He's somebody who's not in the games industry, just as a way to like, yeah, I release the pressure valve on my brain when like creative work gets too tough, like just going out and putting in, you know, even like 5 miles with a friend where we talk about things that are not related to work is really, really good. And then I agree, like I usually have like a script or something that I'm working on just for myself, and that stuff's probably never going to go anywhere, but it's really, really nice, especially on the weekends, to just like go to a coffee shop and open my laptop and like put in a few pages on something that's completely different from whatever it is that I'm working on day to day in the office. It's like, it's nice because like there's no stress associated with the personal project. So it's like, cool, well, I'm just going to do whatever, right? Like this may not actually work. And this scene is like, it's turned into like a 12-page nightmare where it's just like long monologues back and forth, but like, I don't really care. It's just fun to write these people talking right now. And having that is also really good to kind of bring that attitude back into the office then, because it's all, the work is always better when it's not that you don't care, but you're not like feeling so much pressure to make every word perfect, right? So you're kind of like stopping yourself and your own intuition.
Yeah.
It's really nice to have that sensation of just like freedom and exploration of like, well, you know, I don't know where this is going to go, but I'm just going to kind of let it wander on the page until it finds itself. And then like, oh, great. Now I'm at a great idea. Cool. I'm going to cut the like 3 pages that it took me to get here, and I'm going to start from there, you know? So yeah, stuff outside of work is really, really important to keep work healthy.
Yeah. And your point about people outside of work too is great. Like people who, you know, and sometimes it's annoying when you're like games and they're like, what games? Yeah. I don't care about that.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's helpful because they remind you that there's a whole other world out there. But I think there's also, and not everyone can do this. It's a very particular kind of place, and you have to be really lucky with the people, which fortunately I am. It sounds like Insomniac's a good place. If you can be in a place where you can be, at least a little bit emotionally honest and find people who you can talk to about that. I mean, so my previous job at Apple was tech support, and it was not a place where you show vulnerability, because for a variety of reasons, but also it was just a very combative environment, very, a little macho, weirdly, even though it was Apple, which has a good culture, but there's
that's
just
so
something
interesting.
About, yeah,
that's strange.
Something about tech support, it puts everybody kind of on the war path. Cause it was very high pressure. And it was a very, you know, male dominated environment. It was quite, it was just not a place where you'd want to talk about your feelings, which coming out of that and into the games industry, I was like, all right, I'm ready to be a hard ass. I'm ready to do whatever I got to do to fit in this, you know, terrible sexist industry. Cause that's what a lot of it looked like from the outside. And I didn't realize how much good there was in the industry until I joined, which is not everyone's experience, but I was really lucky with it. And I am so happy to be in a place where there is an actual support network. There are people I can go to and I can say, hey, you know what this week has been like. I need to take 10 minutes. I need to leave a little early. I need to, whatever it is, you know, even if it's, you know, do you mind taking this meeting from me? There have been times when I've had to do that, and you can't do it with everything, but just having people who can even just acknowledge that you're having a stressful time, that takes the edge off hugely, I find, because trying to hide the fact that you're having a tough time and that it's a dark period for your project, that takes so much energy, and you just don't have that to spend in those
totally.
Situations.
Totally. Yeah, it's like, it's hard enough. You don't have to like create, like the work itself is hard enough. You don't need this like extra burden of like playing Game of Thrones every time you go into the office. Yeah, that's, well, that's good. I'm so glad that it sounds like Criterion is such a good place to work.
Yeah, it's nice. I was so surprised because it doesn't, I think a lot of studios actually struggle to advertise how great they are. And
or
they
say it, but they're lying.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, I think weirdly, a lot of, it's kind of self-defeating. Like if a studio comes out and is like, hey, by the way, we are awesome. You kind of think, there's something probably wrong there. So yeah, it's the quiet ones, I guess. I mean, Criterion's a very low-key studio, but it's actually one of the most socially progressive, I think. And as far as like banning crunch and supporting people
with,
flexible working hours, all that stuff. It's really good. And I feel like as somebody who's only experienced that, the idea of crunch within the games industry, because a lot of other industries have it and it's terrible, but within games feels so outdated now. So I'm really happy to hear that Insomniac is awesome as well, because it's high time, you know, especially for big AAA companies making big AAA games.
Totally.
There's no excuse.
Yeah, I know. We don't have to start banging the game unionization drum, but that's certainly a conversation.
You can't say that. Either.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But that's certainly, I mean, it's like, it's in the air right now. Like, I feel like every time I meet people from different studios, like you kind of start talking about like, hey, it's like games are super cool, super fun to make. It kind of seems like it's time for the industry to grow up a little bit and establish standards that are going to protect people. Like, I mean, yeah, whatever. I don't have to start. Clearly, I'm a pro-union guy. I don't have to start going down that path. But yeah.
How big is Criterion, Rosa?
It is about 120 people, I think, right now. So it's doubled since I joined 3 years ago. Four years ago, actually. Yeah.
And how big is Insomniac, Ben?
So at the peak of Spider-Man, I think it was like 200, 250 we've got a Burbank office and then one in North Carolina as well.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah, totally. And right now, I honestly have no idea what our numbers are at. Somewhere maybe around like 200-ish, I think.
Oh, and before I forget, Criterion is hiring, right, Rosa?
Yeah, we are. Well, we will be hiring for narrative designers and a lot of other roles in the coming months. So yeah, it's exciting.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to go to the second question on this list.
That's 40 a good
minutes
sign.
In. Nice. Yeah, this is great. So you both worked on big franchises. When you're writing on an existing IP or just like working on in general, how do you nail the voices of established characters and their stories and of the IP as a whole?
That's a good question. Rosa, do you want to go at it this one?
I don't know. I really want to hear your answer to this. I feel like you've just had to do that in such a big way. So I'm really curious.
Yeah, it's I'll take the example of writing for Peter Parker. Was super, super fun. It was a really interesting challenge because like on the one hand, like that character is so important to me. That's like one of the foundational stories and characters of my life that I discovered when I was a young geeky bespectacled boy, and like I looked up to Pete so much, so I feel in many ways like I've grown up with him and I know his voice really, really well. So like when I started working on Spider-Man, on the one hand, like I felt like I could just kind of intuitively write in Peter's voice and it would just kind of like spill out of me. But then on the other hand, I was like very aware of how important this character was to me and to so many other people. So at the same time, I was like really heavily scrutinizing every word. And like John and I, Christos and I, you know, and everybody internally, we would have a lot of conversations throughout production of like, oh man, like would Pete say this? Like, would he be more serious in this moment? Would he make a quip? Like, what's the right, like, what's the most authentic, like Peter Parker thing right now? And it was just an interesting process of like trusting your gut and trusting your instincts, but at the same time, just like being so aware of like, hey, we got to get this right. This character really, really matters to so many people. It matters to us. We don't want to fuck this up and we don't want to just like, you know, throw out lines off the cuff and never, like hold them up in the light and make sure that they're good. So it was kind of a mixture of like automatic writing and like really, really intense scrutiny with like tons of notes, tons of people giving feedback, tons of revisions. And like, I will say that at the end of the day, in terms of like nailing the voice of Peter Parker, I am so like, I bow at the feet of Yuri Lowenthal, the actor who played Pete, because he would take so many lines that on the page were like fine or maybe not that good. And either with his own like improvisation or just with his execution of the line would just like elevate it into like the most amazing, wonderful like piece of dialogue you've ever heard. So I would like constantly tell Yuri at the end of any day in the booth, like, dude, thank you so much. You are making me look good right now. Like you're making me look like a much better writer than I think I actually am. Just through his execution. And that was true across the board. I don't know if that's totally answering the question. It's basically just like you care about the character a lot. There's a lot of pressure. And at the end of the day, you got to hire really good actors and they're going to save you and make you look good, even if you don't figure it out on the page.
It's a great answer.
Yeah, what about you, that Rosa? That is a great way to put it. I mean, I think that most of my experience, I guess, working in established IP, as far as Battlefield, it was pretty straightforward. I've never had to work on any voiced actors in that or voiced narrative, but I have on Star Wars. So when we did the X-Wing VR mission, we also did a mode in Battlefront 2, but that was so gameplay-ish that it was pretty straightforward. The X-Wing VR mission was interesting because we didn't, the initial, I think, idea for it wasn't, didn't have a story in it. It wasn't necessary. Like at the time, VR was very Wild West. It was, nobody really knew what to do with it. So the idea was put somebody in Star Wars and it's going to be amazing. And I'm sure that would have been more than enough, but we just thought, why not put a little, this is the audio team at the time being like, why don't we just take people on a little adventure with this? Mm. And we found a tie-in for it in Rogue One, which was wonderful. But now we had that problem and that pressure of even a 20-minute mission with very minimal VO, really. It's just a little bit of radio banter as you go through it. Most of the storytelling is, and the beats are done visually and what happens around you. And we also had, because of the tie-in to Rogue One, we had a radio interaction with K2SO, the droid. Mm. And so we got to do a session with Alan Tudyk, which is amazing.
That's so much fun.
Oh, man. That's incredible. And that was exactly that case where I we worked with some amazing writers on it. We worked with Chris Remo and Nick Brecken on that, and they did a wonderful job. But it wasn't until we got the actors to speak it that it felt like Star Wars, because so much of Star Wars for me is in the characterful moments. And of course it's big and epic, but the chatter, the things people say to each other, it's often quite familiar and it kind of feels like sibling rivalry a little bit, the little groups of people you get who are all trying to save the universe or destroy it. But in between all of those moments of fighting and drama, they're just people with their own issues and their own stuff going on. And so we got really lucky with the cast of it. And certainly in the K2SO session, it was like, okay, I read these lines. I can imagine somebody saying it in a kind of droidy voice. And as soon as he was reading it, it was real.
Yeah.
And I believed it. It was so cool. So wow. I think part of it is just knowing the material really well, but also figuring out what it is that, what's the difference between the voice of the character and the IP itself, because they're so not the same thing. And, the Star Wars IP has a huge range of characters in it, massive. Some of them are hilarious. Some of them are tragic. Some of them are awful. And, as in mean. And there's a huge range of characters in Star Wars, and none of them are synonymous with the Star Wars IP. So there's a lot to pull from, which is great. But then the question of what do I choose to put in this game was huge and was really, it was kind of a paralysis of choice until we figured, let's just write a small, close-knit group of people. We don't have to cover all bases. We don't need big backstories. We don't need any of that. because ultimately one of the reasons Star Wars works is because it is super relatable. The characters are super relatable and the conversations are super relatable. So if we nail that, we can fit a lot into a 20-minute session. And yeah, it was a lot of fun. And it actually made me like Star Wars more than I already did, because I don't think I'd ever thought about why I liked it until made that.
Cool.
Yeah. That's really cool.
It was nice. Yeah.
So Ben, given your background in directing and being in VO and performance capture sessions, and Rosa, given your background in VO directing, what both of you say are the best methods for getting the best possible performances out of actors? It already sounds like hiring good actors does a lot of the work.
Oh, yeah.
100%. Yeah. And I'll actually say, like, I do, like, under pressure, I will direct VO, but I'm really bad at it. So, Rosa, I'm super interested to hear how you approach this.
Oh, wow. Well, I love directing VO. I don't know how good I am at it, because I can't tell how much of the work is just being done with it by the actors. I'm always, acting is also something that I never really wanted to be an actress. I didn't have that phase growing up. So, and I'm terrified of performance. So to see people doing what they do with a script is incredible. And I love them for it. And so I always want them to feel as much like equal partners as possible, because they have spent their entire career, you know, and before, in their education, in their lives, figuring out how to do this really well. So they'll realize aspects of the character that I wouldn't ever have thought about. Like, their creative process for realizing a character is going to be much more involved than anything I can give them as far as source material. So I try to be quite economical with the reference material I give them and not too prescriptive. So I never do line reads to them saying, this is how I think it should sound. And I always, you know, time allowing, I always give them the option of changing a line to make it sound more like it's in their voice. Because if it fits their accent or just the cadence with which they speak or some of their mannerisms, if you can get that in there, then from a player perspective, they're probably not going to notice, but part of them is going to be thinking, how is this so real and natural? Like, how it just feels like this is the person. And it is, because there's enough of the human being injected into that character to make it feel really authentic. So I'm a big fan of being really flexible with actors, inviting them into the process as much as possible. If it's possible, sometimes it's really fun to get the actors involved early and actually shape the character a little bit around them. Because again, it just makes it much more real, and it adds some unpredictable creative elements into the thing. And I'm not an auteur. I don't think that I can just envision the character all by myself. So having them come in and actually suggest things, they don't have the background of working on the IP, on the game. So they're going to bring something fresh that I would never have thought of. And that's been beneficial so many times. And the other thing that I like doing is reading back, because a conversation where, I mean, I hear this in games all the time, a conversation that clearly was kind of read out as line after line after line. It's sometimes you have to do it for time's sake, but if you can get away with the readbacks, it is so worth it for smooth conversation flow.
Yeah, we did it a little bit on Spider-Man, and we're trying to do it more and more dual mic sessions where we have both actors that are in the middle, because we do a lot of like radio calls when you're swinging around in the open world. And so it's so nice when you actually have like the two actors who are really talking to each other, and they can play off of each other's energy and really listen to each other and discover those things that you wouldn't see if you were just reading in isolation, you know, like figuring out like, oh, actually, like, we thought this was a joke, but it's kind of serious, man. It's so much more interesting if I kind of needle you with this instead of just throw it away, and it gets this really interesting reaction from you. Like the more that it can be, the more that the actors, as you say, can just like be active participants in shaping the character, and you can really hand off the work to them and let them carry it to a totally new place, that's when it gets really, really special. That's when it's super fun.
Yeah, and it's totally okay to tell them that, right? Like I love positive reinforcement in general, but I also really enjoy being able to tell an actor, usually, you know, the earlier the better, to say, here's something you did with that I really liked, or that really felt like it, you know, it was inspirational, whatever it is, whatever the wording is, it says to them, this is a safe space to do that. Because not all voice directors are okay with that. you know, and I'm sure, Ben, you, as you'll know, not all directors are okay with that as well.
Oh, totally. Yeah. It's interesting. So I've directed for film and TV in the past, and like sometimes like on the PCAP stage, like I will end up giving some direction. But I found it so nice since I've been on this project to like kind of just be the writer, you know, and like work on the words and then come to set or come to the VO booth with, you know, whether it's Brian Weiser or Mike Yosh, like one of our like animation directors, or Chris Zimmerman, our VO director, and just like watching them do their thing, working with the actors is so magical. Like Chris in particular, when she's directing VO, like if an actor comes to me and like wants like a note or like some information on the character, they're probably going to get like a 3-page monologue that like explains all of the detail of like who this person is. And like Chris is so good at like taking a moment, thinking, and then saying like 3 words that are just like the perfect things that the actor needed to hear right in that moment to just kind of push them in the right direction to find the heart of the line or the moment or whatever. It's such wonderful alchemy. I really, really love having the privilege of working with such talented people and getting to see them create incredible things.
I want to know how your backgrounds in directing have helped your storytelling process now, like outside of actual, when you're directing actors, like when you're actually writing a story or designing, has directing helped you at all?
Yes, definitely. I mean, so much. It's especially because going through the process and just being conscious of that process is helpful. It's kind of like, it's like anything in games. If you can be conscious of a different process, you'll understand how to work in a way that enables it to be better. But for narrative, especially, because so much of the story is going to come through in the voiceover. And I've met, you know, wonderful writers who have made amazing stuff on games that haven't represented their vision through the voice because it was recorded in isolation, or it was recorded super late and last minute and rushed, or they weren't able to be there, whatever the reason is. The more those two, disciplines can work together on achieving a great result, the better it's going to be. So everything I do is framed by the kind of lurking elephant in the room of this is going to be recorded in a voiceover, and that's going to be the way that the players are going to get it. And from a player experience, they don't care that I wrote 25 pages of documentation on a narrative system that's going to be communicated through Barks. They just care about that experience. So I'm always thinking about it. And if I'm thinking about casting very early and the use of voice very early, usually that means that I use it more effectively as well, rather than designing a whole narrative thing and then figuring out how we can, you know, where are the words going to be in this? It's usually something I think about very early. I stay quite tight with the audio team because we're all going to have to think about it further down the line. So I'll get them involved. If we're talking about some special vocal processing or a different recording technique, I try to involve them. And it's a little nerdy. It's probably not essential, but it's what I like to do because the thing that I'm working on is going to be realized by that team. So really they're the ones who are going to decide how much of what I'm imagining and what me and my team are building is going to make it into the final product. And it's also made me really snobbish about VO, to be honest. It's meant that I feel like my standards are now a lot higher than they were before I did VO directing, because I'm now sensitive to the things that don't work and the things that bug me in games now. Having done VO directing, I can kind of tell when they've used the same actor for 20 characters and they haven't really changed it much, that kind of thing.
Yeah, we noticed that too.
Yeah, it's a curse.
Yeah, it's so interesting after having worked on games, exactly as you say, just like starting to pay attention to more like the emergent audio system that's happening under the hood. Or like, I remember when I was playing God of War last year, one of the things that just continuously like impressed me was their conversation interrupt and resume system. It was just like, it was so fluid and it felt so natural. I was like, oh, God, how did these guys figure this out? Did they write like bespoke interrupt lines for like every possible point in the conversation? Like they've got this timed out well with the animations. It's really, really, it's cool to be kind of behind the curtain and be able to see those things now in the stuff that you're consuming.
But Spider-Man did that too, right?
So we did that too because we had been talking about it before, but like we started playing God of War and we were like, dude, these guys are doing this. They're doing it really well. We definitely have to figure this out now. And so like that was kind of the push that we needed to like get, the programming resources and the design resources to really execute on that. And I mean, something that we had always been doing is we were recording multiple versions of Yuri's lines, both when he was like swinging versus when he was perched, so that his level of exertion would try to always match whatever it is that the player was doing at the moment.
Which is incredible.
It's so cool.
It's super cool. It was, man, that was one of those things where there was definitely a point during production, because it made every session with him take twice as long. And Yuri's incredible. He can do his first take almost always winds up in the game, and he can move so quickly through lines. It's just amazing, but it still means you're doing twice as many lines. And there's definitely a point in production where I remember I was tired. I was like grumpy, and I was like, man, why are we even doing this? Nobody's going to notice this. This is ridiculous. Like there's no player that's going to hear this. And one of our audio guys at the time, Jeremy Hall, was like, no, trust me, this is going to be good. Like, you know, we're in the process right now. You don't really see it, but once it starts coming online, it's going to make a difference. Even if people can't tell you why it makes a difference, it's going to make a difference.
Yeah.
And it was so gratifying when the game got released to see articles where people were noticing it. And just like, it's like, man, that really was worth, it took a lot of time and effort to figure out on the code side, to then execute with Yuri in the booth. But it was totally worth it. It just makes it feel that much more like it's a story about a human being and not just a video game character, which is cool.
Out of curiosity, what was Yuri doing in the booth when he had to be exerted?
Yeah, actually, I just had a conversation with him about this recently where I was like, man, so how did you figure out the right way to do this? And so I don't think he ever wants videos of this to come out, but I think it's like, it's just amazing where he'll be in the booth and he'll actually kind of be miming swinging a little bit, but he was talking to me about like the thing that he had to dial in was you couldn't put the exertion just up in the shoulders around your throat, because if you do that, it starts to sound like, you know, you're on the toilet and you're trying to force something out. He really had to keep it down in his abs and in his gut and just kind of keep that like always tense and flexed. And that would give like just the right amount of exertion where it's like, okay, this feels like he's doing something, but he's still Spider-Man. This should be like relatively effortless, but there is a difference between like Spider-Man standing on a building versus in a nosedive off the Empire State, you know?
Yeah.
There's somewhere there exists cell phone footage of Yuri Lowenthal miming, swinging as he's talking, you know, to Aunt May about the Feast Center.
And crunching his abs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Has directing helped your work too with the work you're doing now, Ben?
100%. And I would say in the most basic and immediate way is that the more time that you spend on set or in the booth with actors, listening to them deliver things, the better your ear gets and the more it sharpens your intuition when you're then like back in your room or back in the office, just working on a script in isolation, you start to develop a better instinct for like, you know, whether or not a line is actually going to sound good when it's read aloud, whether you're using too many words, not enough words. And especially like being on the PCAP set or being on like a live action set and starting to develop a sense for when like you don't need any words, you just need a reaction shot, right? This moment is going to play way, way better if he doesn't say anything, if we just see his face, or maybe not even his face. Maybe we're going to cut to MJ's face and see how she's feeling about the moment. But we don't need to say anything here, right? And that then, definitely the experience of working in film, kind of in the way that Rosa was talking about as well, it propagates out to all these other departments where you start to think about like, okay, well, how can we use, you know, sound design or Foley to help sweeten this emotional moment? Like, how can we use color and light and composition to really hit whatever beat we're going for, if we want to make it sad or make it feel enthusiastic and happy, like what can we do aside from using words and language to give players an emotional experience? And that
narrative design.
Narrative design. That's Yay. It. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, definitely like directing is great for getting you out of just the discipline of language and words and writing and really thinking about story as being this all-encompassing experience that's like everything that comes at the player that they see and hear from the moment they put the game in to the moment they turn off their TV, you know?
Yeah. And like switch tax a little bit. I'm always curious to hear what was a recent storytelling quagmire you found yourself in that you can talk about and how did you get out of it?
Yeah. Well, I can take that one unless you have one on the tip of your tongue, Rosa.
Go for it.
So this is kind of behind the wall of an NDA, so I can't get like super specific.
That's but, cool.
This is kind of talking about the importance of like the team in solving problems. Like we've got kind of our core creative team that's working on a project right now, story driven, super excited about it. People are liking the characters, they're liking the story overall. But we kept running into an issue with our third act and specifically our climax, where kind of early on in production, our key creative team fell in love with this idea for what we wanted to have happen in the climax. And we all thought it was like, oh, this is going to be a great, great idea. It's going to be so good, so cathartic, so satisfying. But then as we started working on the thing and developing the characters and figuring out the rest of the story, that idea that we had fallen in love with became less and less relevant. And we could just feel it every time we were presenting this finale to the team, whenever we were pitching it to outsiders. It was like, yeah, this doesn't work. And that was the feedback that we were consistently getting. It's like, yeah, the story is really great up until this moment at the end. And then it feels like it turns into a totally different story. But we were all like so in love with this thing, we couldn't possibly see another way to solve the problem and to resolve the story. And so this is a thing that one of our writers, Sam Maggs, has kind of brought into Insomniac that has been just really, really great, which is holding like story conferences where we bring in people from other teams on other projects who have very little exposure to whatever it is that we're working on actively, and they can kind of be an objective third party to help us brainstorm solutions. So we did this fairly recently where we held like a 2-hour story conference. I sent out notes about like, hey, this is the problem. This is the background in our story. This is the moment that we're looking at. This is why we think it doesn't work, but we can't figure out what else to do. And so we just sat in a room and I was like at the whiteboard holding a marker, just listening to a dozen people from different teams inside Insomniac give kind of objective third party perspective on what they thought was going on, and basically just letting them solve the problem for us, more or less, right? We're like, somebody was like, oh, you know, I mean, the moment doesn't really work because I feel like the character would never do that. They would do this instead. And then somebody else would be like, oh, yeah, well, if they do that, then the other one can do this. And just like naturally, people start building on each other. And now, coming out of that that story conference, we're feeling insanely confident about the climactic moment that we have. It seems to really, really work. Every time we present it, people like get a chill in their spine, which is exactly what we want. And it's really all thanks to like other people figuring out the problem for us, you know? But yeah. That's why having a great team is so important, and being willing to seek help and advice and perspective outside of your own little bubble is really, really key as well.
That's great.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. It was fun.
Do you have one, Rosa?
I do. I mean, there's actually a few, but I think one that I can talk about is not my most recent couple of projects, but a little while ago, I was working on a project in which there were, so it was on the Starfighter Assault mode of Battlefront 2. And we had a design for a level, and they all have phases of the battle. And the design was coming in super late for reasons, and it was all understandable reasons, but design was trying to figure out what the most fun way would be to present this level. And we were trying to figure out the right framing for it narratively, because even though there wasn't a ton of narrative in those levels, there was still like commander voiceover and wingmate voiceover that was supposed to carry you through to the final stage of it, the final phase. And the design for the final phase was super, super in flux. And this is just like, for me, it was 101 in not getting too attached and in being okay with killing your darlings. And the script work on that was a combination of writer's work. And then on my end, I was doing a lot of VO directing. And inevitably, I would end up doing some script editing. But I wasn't sure if I could actually write lines for it. Like, I wasn't sure. I didn't really want to be doing that work. I wanted the writer to get to do it. And we were pretty attached to the final, similarly, we were pretty attached to the final design. And it was inevitably going to change. And we were getting closer and closer to the date in which we had to record this voiceover, and we didn't know what the final design was going to be. It just wasn't going to be decided in time. And we ended up needing to write, I think mostly me, three variants of the final level script to accommodate all the potential final designs. So there was a lot of like, what's a way we can say this that's neutral so that it will work for a bunch of different designs? What's a way that we can say this that accommodates a couple of different final design options? Because we knew, I kind of worked with the design team to figure out what's the three most likely choices. But even within those, I wanted to make sure that if there was a fourth, we would still have a lot of usable VO, so we would have to do minimal pickups. So it was a very, you know, memorable experiences in game development experience. And it was only because the designers were willing to sit down with me and actually help me hash out what the different options might be that we could do it. And because we were able to overcome, no, it's got to be this script. This has been the script for ages. Surely, you know, this has all those snappy one-liners that I really like, and they won't work if it changes. And yeah, it was intense. And then we had the name for something changed as I was on the train to the recording session. So I just kind of did find and replace in the Excel sheet. And amazingly, it worked. It was fine, and it was a lot of fun, and it makes cohesive sense. But it kind of taught me like the value of communication, the value of not being too committed to the way that a script is written until it's actually in the game, and just to not count on things not changing. Like, until it ships, I'm always sort of slightly on alert for changes to come in.
Totally. Yeah. Iteration is the only rule. It's always going to change. Yeah.
How often would you two say that things come down to the wire? You say like more common or less common?
For me, it's more common. Yeah. And And that's just because you make it that way, right? Like, if you give me a week until the session, I'm going to keep editing until the session.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, that's, I think one of the questions that was on your list about, like, when do you know when you're done writing? Yeah. And it's like, oh, well, like when we have to shoot it, or when we have to record it, or when we have to ship it. It's like, that's when it's done, you know?
Totally.
Yeah.
So how do you know when you're done, when you don't have a deadline?
I will say, in my own case, if I don't have a deadline, that's a guarantee that I will never be finished, you know? So I need to have that external pressure, or at least sometimes sending it to someone I trust and them saying like, yeah, you know, this is good. This is a solid draft. Let's send this out, you know? But I benefit a lot from being in production and having boundaries that I have to plan and work inside.
I am exactly the same. Yeah. I think when I was trying to figure out what my answer would be to this question, I just wrote, I don't. Like, I literally don't know when something's done. If I have, and this is why sometimes I hear about folks who do work in an environment where they don't have a deadline. Like, if they have funding such that they don't have a deadline, or they're Rockstar. In whatever situation. Yeah. I mean, well, whatever it is, I mean, I just don't think I could cope with that. I can't self-impose those deadlines very well. It was disastrous in university. I have no idea how I graduated. Like, I will always just use the time up until the deadline. And if, you know, you always think, oh, I'll start working on my final year project sort of a year in advance, and I'll finish it early.
Yeah.
It totally. Never happens.
That's not going to happen. Yeah, that's not going to work. Yeah.
A bit of a different question. In your free time, do you both feel obligated to play other games to stay up to date with what they're doing with storytelling? Or do you try to take in other mediums so you can bring something new to the table? Or both?
Do you want to take this one, Ben?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, I don't think I necessarily feel obligated. Luckily, I love games. I love playing games. So I kind of just naturally end up playing things. But definitely, being in the office, there are times where something will release that I otherwise might not have been super interested in. But because there's so much conversation about it in the office, it's like, well, I kind of want to be able to participate in this. You know, James or Cam or Jess or somebody is telling me that there's something really interesting happening in this game, so I should check it out. That's kind of the case right now, where I definitely slept on Detroit Become Human, but there are a couple people in the office right now who are playing through it for the first time, and they're pointing out some really interesting moments. And it's like, okay, well, I otherwise might not be super interested in this game, but I'm going to load it up and I'm going to play through it because I want to get to this point that, you know, Cam is telling me is amazing and does something that he's never seen before, and that seems worthwhile. So I'll play it out of social obligation, I guess, but not necessarily like a strong professional obligation.
Yeah, okay. Is that the same for you, Rosa?
Yeah, I would say similar. I don't feel, I do feel kind of creatively obligated in a fun way, in that I feel like to be good at my job and to make things that I love to make in a way that's relevant for people now, I want to be up to speed on what's happening. So I really do like to try something new, and I like to keep a very diverse portfolio of games going if possible. Like, I definitely have spells where I'm just like, oh, I'm just not feeling mobile games, or I'm just not feeling shiny AAA games. But I'll usually try to find something to latch onto in those spheres, because I do want to be exposed to different kinds of games and understand what the constraints of those games are, because usually they have some implication for what I'm working on, even if it's nothing like those games. And the same goes for media. I think having some cultural literacy is really helpful for anyone who's involved in storytelling of any kind, because you do want to understand what people are interested in. And people are the ones who are going to play the games. They're the ones I want to understand. They're the ones I want to reach. So I do need to have some ability to talk about and some points of view on the things that they really love. Like, I recently made myself watch all of Breaking Bad, and it was amazing. But it was also, there were points where I was like, I need a break. I need to go play Stardew Valley. Yeah. But it was worth it, because now I am that guy where I'm like, hey, you know, in Breaking Bad when they do this thing, yeah, and everyone's like, come on, Rosa.
Yeah. So we got to put this guy's head on a turtle.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically. Have you considered for this narrative beat? Yeah. It's nice. And it means that I get to experience some things that I wouldn't have otherwise, because as Ben was saying, you know, I make myself go check them out, and then I find out that I enjoy them, and it's really nice. So it's a little bit social, it's a little bit work, it's a lot of just, I don't want to be narrow-minded in any way. So sometimes it means going back and watching something really old, because that's a thing I missed, and now I want to see what it's all about.
Yeah, I just, James Cooper, one of the designers at the office, he keeps telling me that I need to watch The OA on Netflix. So I just started watching that. And it's actually like, it started the first episode. I was like, oh, what is this? The acting is the writing. I can't deal with this. And now I'm like almost seven episodes in, and I'm really, really into it. Like, I keep texting him every night, like, oh, dude, what's going to happen with this character? What's going to happen with this character? So yeah, sometimes I like that idea of, you know, we're making stuff to connect with people and tell the stories of people. So it's worth it to get to know people and not just pay attention to video games. I really like that idea.
So go ahead. Sorry.
Well, just the last thing, this is one of my favorite soapboxes, is playing the games that people play. And that's one of the reasons I love playing mobile games, because it does open up a whole new world to me of games that are just so different from what I'm used to, like both the really premium ones like Florence, which are amazing, and also some of the ones that are just standard free-to-play stuff, because playing different kinds of games to the ones that you normally play is just as enlightening sometimes.
Totally, totally, totally.
Like, Rosa, what was the last mobile game that surprised you with how good it was?
Ooh, that's a really good question. I think it was probably Brawl Stars. I was obsessed with that game for a while. I loved it. It brought me. Sorry, my words are failing me. This is it. We've hit the limit. It brought me a ton of joy. I loved playing it. It made me feel happy and validated all the time. And I'm sure that was the result of some very careful data-driven design and serious focus testing. But it worked. It worked. And that was really fun. Let's see, what else have I been playing? I do enjoy the crossword. I was also playing Another Case Solved, which is this really kind of goofy detective game that I think EA published years ago.
Oh, interesting.
And mostly you're just like rescuing cats and it's kind of a match three type thing. That was really fun. And I played Guildmaster Story, which is an indie mobile game. And it's great. You should check it out. It's free. And it's one of the most just incisive attacks on a whole bunch of social stuff to a degree. It's an attack on the ultra wealthy, the oblivious ultra wealthy, and it's also a comment on like how experience points are used in games. It's a little meta. It's a lot meta.
That sounds cool.
Yeah, but it is really cool. It's really cool. It's just written in a way that made me like laugh, but also want to cry because it was too real. Yeah, it was good.
It will be in the show notes.
Yeah, great.
Ben, are there any mobile games or just normal games in general that have surprised you?
I just downloaded some like Line Runner type thing on my iPad that I was playing before this that was just beautiful. I think it's called Alto's Odyssey. Super, super fun.
So good.
Is Detroit surprising you?
Detroit so far it is not. David Cage is not yet surprising me, but I'm gonna make it through.
I think we can confidently say we'll never have David Cage on this podcast.
Yeah. I mean, I do, man. The opening of Indigo Prophecy is still one of the coolest things I've seen in terms of like legitimately building tension and suspense in a game. I feel like those are some of the most familiar emotions from film and TV, and it's so hard to get those legitimately into a video game of really building a sustained feeling of tension. And so I do love that. The thing that I played latest that I think I've been the most impressed by is I finally started playing Celeste, and that game is just beautiful. And the storytelling is so surprising in it. Like, I really, really enjoy that game.
Like, what surprised you about it specifically?
So that, just talking about like the idea of keeping the player and the player character's consciousness in the same place, I was really, really, I guess, caught off guard because it's a side scroller. I would not expect any kind of storytelling in a side scroller. That like it often seemed like the player character was voicing the thoughts and feelings that I was having about any given scenario that she was encountering. And I was also just struck by how empathetic it was. I haven't finished it yet, but have you guys played the game? I don't want to spoil it if you haven't.
We have not, but we know what the game is.
Okay. So I'll be kind of vague, but there's a certain point where you meet a ghost who has a great deal of anxiety. And the way that that anxiety manifests is funny and sad and surprising and eventually kind of scary in a way that, like, it sounds kind of like you were describing, I think you were saying it was Guild Wars, the game that you were playing, Rosa?
Oh, no, Guildmaster Story.
Guildmasters, yeah. So it felt like very real in a way that I was not expecting from like a super hardcore side scrolling like 2D game. But it was just really cool. The game is insanely hard though. It's like, you know, From Software hard. So I had to put it down at a certain point, but, it's fun. It's really worth it.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Is there anything that immediately takes both you out of a story in a game? You talked about it a bit with like bad VO direction, but is there anything else?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the VO one is definitely part of it, but from more of a like writing and narrative design angle, anytime a character has to say out loud what I'm supposed to do next, in a really obvious way, it just breaks. And this might be like a game dev problems thing where you've done it, and I've done it. I've written those lines and I hate myself for it. But if you have to do it, you have to do it. But as a player, it just makes me immediately go, this is a line that's just for utility. There was no other elegant way to do this, so they made it a line. And it, you know, because I then stop playing and start analyzing, it takes me out of the experience.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah, we always, our VO director, Chris, calls those stupid player lines. And it's like, well, sometimes we have to record them, but it is, John Paquette and I talk about that a lot. Like, our preference would be to never include helper lines like that. Like, just lines that are coming from character, talking about the emotional response to situations, not telling you that you need to go punch 10 bad guys before you do X, Y, and Z, you know? But yeah, they're unavoidable, and I've certainly written my fair share of them as well. I think I've repeated this a few times, but anytime it really feels like the protagonist is either behind or ahead of my understanding of what's going on in the world, that really throws me out of it. Like, whether it's I see some big reveal with another character coming and the protagonist does not, that can be really frustrating. Or if it's just like kind of simple in the moment stuff where, like, I walk into a new environment and to me it's really overwhelming and beautiful and cool and strange or scary, but the protagonist isn't saying anything, or if they're commenting on aspects of it that I don't find interesting. Anytime I fall out of sync with what the player character is thinking and feeling and expressing, that pulls me out of the experience.
I think we'll do the last question now. If you could change one thing about development, what would it be?
Oh, gosh.
Or actually, I'll give you two possible questions to answer. Would you rather do that one, or what's the thing you wish people understood more about your job?
I don't know. I like hot takes, so I kind of want to do the change one thing about development.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I have some hot takes if you want.
Yeah, throw them out.
Do it.
So I think that on some level, the answer is I wish we didn't have crunch, and I do. But I think the thing that I wish most is that dev teams represented players a little more. I do mean in terms of like diversity and inclusion. I think that if I could snap my fingers and make every dev team a lot more equally distributed in terms of gender, ability level, sexuality, orientation, race, gender identity, all of that stuff, we would have much healthier teams. And that's just because we would have to empathize more. We would have to communicate more. We wouldn't be able to fall into old habits. We wouldn't be able to create us and them situations as easily, we wouldn't make games that were as homogenous as a lot of games are. And I think things are getting better for sure. The industry is so much more inclusive and welcoming and colorful and wonderful than I ever expected it to be. And so are the games that are coming out, but we still have a long way to go. Like, we're still in a situation where if I walk into a game studio and I see more than like 10 women on the dev floor, I'm like, wow, this is
yeah.
Oh, gosh,
yeah, I know.
So yeah, so we have a way to go. And I think it would make the games better as well, as well as creating a better environment.
100% does. I mean, I will say that, like, so coming from Spider-Man, where it was me and John and Christos, three dudes working on it, to now, you know, we've got Mary, Sam, and I am not sure if I'm allowed to say that we have another writer starting, but we do have another woman joining the team pretty soon, to like a more 50-50 gender split. It's like, it makes the work so much better because there's just, everybody works from their own life experience. That's what you bring to the table. And I'm, you know, a white dude from Nebraska. I've had a particular experience of the world, and that's what I bring to my work. It makes it feel so much more alive and real and valuable when you have a lot of different perspectives in the room, all speaking about what it is that they know of life and existence, you know? So it's really, I would 100% agree with that. Like, it is shocking sometimes to come into the office and still see, like, wow, this seems like I'm walking into, you know, Mad Men or like 1953. Like, it's so imbalanced gender-wise.
Well, congratulations on your writing team. That's, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah, they are great. I'm extremely lucky to be working with so many talented people. I 100% agree with both of Rose's hot takes with Crunch and like diversity behind as well as in front. The thing kind of process-wise that I keep talking about internally, and I don't know if this is ever going to be solved, is like in film and TV, you start with a script, and generally at this point, like you can take a script and you can budget it and you can kind of read through it and figure out whether or not it's going to work creatively. Like it's easy to squint at a low cost blueprint for the end product that can give you an idea of what the end product is going to be. And my experience so far in games is like there's no equivalent for that kind of foundational document. It's really, really hard to know whether or not something's going to be fun to play until it's actually stood up and working in the engine and people can get their hands on it. Like you can document things till the cows come home. You can write up like these beautiful like explanations of how you think all the gameplay systems are going to work. And it just doesn't matter until you get it in the game and put it in players' hands and find out if it's actually working or not. And most times it doesn't work. And then you spend a lot of time trying to iterate and get it to a point where it works. But it seems like issues with like crunch and planning and budgets could be resolved if there was an easier way to, and a more effective way to plan out projects in pre-production that would give you an idea of like the scope and the potential, you know, creative challenges earlier. But maybe that just doesn't exist in our medium. I don't really know.
Or if it does, maybe it can't translate to all development teams or sizes.
Totally.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I don't know if it'll be answered, but I think it's also, I don't know whose job this is, but
yeah,
it's about understanding what it takes to make a certain game of a certain size. And like, I've talked to people in the sports teams, for example, at EA, and they have unpredictable dev cycles sometimes, because even though, you know, you can make that joke of, oh, FIFA is the same game every year,
right,
but there's always enough that's different, especially now that they've started doing storytelling and things, that that it throws a spanner in the works a bit and they have to adapt. So, but I also think that they can be more honest about what goes into their games, and maybe some other companies that make similar games, like, I don't know, maybe Ubisoft has some great ideas here. If you're making games in a similar style, maybe you get better at saying, this is actually how many people it takes. I think a lot of game companies aren't willing to say, you know what, we're going to need this many sound designers, this many animators. It's going to cost this much, because no one wants to admit that. And that's how you end up ballooning with a lot of contractors in the middle, where you freak out and realize how big it is. Like, AAA games are so expensive at this point. Even indie games are expensive. You know, the shiny ones.
Yeah.
Totally.
So, yeah, we just got to get a little more honest, I think.
Yes, I will agree with that.
That's good. Being more honest. Good way to end this episode.
Great.
So before we go, how can people find you both on the internet, like on Twitter, if you have Twitter? Yeah.
Yeah, I do. I am at Supernova Rosa on Twitter.
Yeah, and I think that I am just at Ben Arfman on Twitter.
And you can find this podcast on Scriptlock Cast on Twitter. Our art is done by Lily Nishida, and music done by Too Mellow. And that's everything. Yes. Thank you too for coming on again. Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me.
This was really fun. Thanks so much, guys.